We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Monday, March 25th, 2024. Can you feel the opening day fever yet? We are just a few days away before the 2024 season begins, as the Detroit Tigers will be visiting the Chicago White Sox. And yes, the weather does look promising for opening day, but before we get there, a few roster items remain for the White Sox, especially when it comes to the bullpen. As we record this episode, we still don't have a final roster, so we'll do our best later in the show to guess how that 26-man roster will look on opening day. But first, there was a bit of controversy in the White Sox media sphere prior to the weekend, and it has to do with this idea of culture. That word is going to be brought up a lot by Pedro Grifol this season. No matter if the losses pile up, it's about building culture, folks. You can't measure culture, but you could see it. You could feel it. Joining me to discuss this idea of culture and why, for what it seems to be the 10th straight year, the Chicago White Sox are chasing after this clubhouse dream is the Sox Machine beat reporter James Fegan and managing editor Jim Margulis. And James, Pedro Grifol says a lot of things. From Daryl Van Scowen earlier on Sunday, quote, "I don't have a message to fans," Grifol said. "I don't think they want one. They want to see us go out and play, and I say that because I'm a fan. I don't want to hear it. I want to see it." Last year, before opening day, shout out to Johnny Baseball on Twitter for reminding me, he told the media, quote, "Just watch us play. Give us a chance. Watch us play. Develop your own opinions on this year. Nothing in the past. Just a clear, clean view and evaluate us and what's happening now," end quote. And the White Sox would go on to lose 101 games that his bosses got fired. This isn't commentary on what Chuck Garfine said on the NBC Sports White Sox Talk podcast, but this idea of building a new culture comes from Pedro Grifol, James, and he's been sticking to the campaign notes of mentioning building this new club culture since last July. So what does Pedro Grifol actually mean, or what is he trying to get at with this whole idea of culture?
What are any of us trying to get at, I guess? I don't know. It's a very broad question, I guess. What can you narrow it down a bit more?
So last year, when things were just on fire for the White Sox, Scott Merkin in July tweeted a quote from Grifol, quote, "Culture's a big part of it. It's not quantifiable. A lot of people don't believe in it. I've lived it. When you go to two World Series in a row and you see a clubhouse and you see an organization and you see culture in place, I just believe in culture," end quote. Like, he seems very fixated on this premise of, if I can establish a good culture in the clubhouse, it will turn things around for the Chicago White Sox. And I'm trying to wrap my head around, like, what does that even mean? Like, for me, I need tangible stuff. Like, let's talk about player development. When he talks about the team needing to walk more, okay, that's something that we could focus on. And I agree with you, Pedro. But like, good vibes? Is that what they're aiming for? I mean, are they looking to be less hostile towards each other than they were last year?
Sure, I guess they could be part of it. I mean, I feel like it's a new stand-in, like catch-all word that used to be just like clubhouse chemistry and stuff like that. But instilling good work habits or attention to detail or attendance or cooperation in meetings and stuff like that. But all of it's really just kind of trying to allude to what would produce a more detail-oriented or more mistake-avoidant team on the field. Like, I think if they talk about how good they are at like verbalizing or giving feedback or sharing accountability within players or having you know, players kind of teach things to each other or give insights to one another, all that is just stuff we kind of look for on in retrospect when like a team shows signs of just playing well and you know, traits or positive traits from the pitching staff being spread across other members of the pitching staff or consistently aggressive base running or successful base running. I feel like it's all just stuff we start asking. It's like, what spurred this when we see a team that like plays well or plays sharply? I think it was only after watching the Guardians like run around like maniacs that you kind of wonder like, well, what did they do to kind of fortify this approach? Or what was the conversations like when they decided they're going to play this way? It wasn't like, you know, there probably was a bunch of annoying culture articles from spring training that year, but I feel like actual curiosity and like, all right, what's behind this only follows the success and tangible stuff you're talking about. So it can often feel like we're talking in a circle or just like talking about our imaginary friend until something like actually shows up on the field that like validates that something's working with this ball club. So let's talk about it.
Was that clubhouse well poisoned before the 2023 season began, James? Like, did you get bad vibes from that clubhouse before the season began?
I am not the sort of person who's going to tell you like what my vibes are, unless that's just like a euphemism for, you know, what people literally told me. And by this time last spring, everyone's saying like, yeah, we're really driven by the failure of last year. We never want to have that happen again. And it wasn't until All-Star break or, you know, by the time the team's getting broken up that you feel people like in retrospect saying like, yeah, you know, we said we're taking things seriously, but we never hit that other gear. We never started playing hard in spring. We never started focusing or fixing our mistakes. The conversations about how we're going to fix things or, you know, things getting addressed, that stuff was never really happening. No one was taking it seriously. It's only like the sort of thing that you hear after it's kind of fallen on its face. But this time last spring, you know, as much as like the vibes were probably not great in terms of like all we're talking about every day is Clevinger or suspensions or other issues that have come up, I don't think there was anybody like saying like, yo man, this ship's going down until actual April started and they're getting their head kicked in. It was kind of like, wow, there's silence in this clubhouse all the time, and you know, people seem to be just trying to talk themselves into the idea that they're going to be all right. But right now I'm looking up historical comps of teams that have ever come back from this sort of hole. And there's like one Texas Rangers team from 9 years ago. So that doesn't seem great. Like there wasn't these obvious like feelings or vibes that I feel like are easy to quantify in any way that is meaningful.
So Jim, this is not a new topic when it comes to the White Sox. Like we've been hearing about this for a decade. And Pedro's bringing this up maybe as a smokescreen, as James alluded to. Isn't the task of overhauling the clubhouse culture, though, borderline impossible, especially because there's so many new players in this roster, Jim? Like, huge roster churn coming into this season. So whatever good vibes you build today doesn't necessarily mean they carry on to next season.
Yeah, that's, I think right now you have like a clubhouse that's running on parallel tracks to like a big picture that's healthy, because you have all these players who are like towards the end of their careers, or at least at junctures in their careers where that could determine whether they get another major league deal or a multi-year deal versus whether they're playing the minor league contract game and kind of bouncing from spring training to spring training. So it is like big for like Paul DeJong, and it's probably big for Kevin Pillar, who, you know, just had some reality in that regard lately. Like Nicky Lopez, you know, he got a taste of the utility infielder lifestyle, like bench player, and now this is, here's a chance for him to try to reestablish himself as a starter. So like, he's got to take that seriously. So you have a lot of guys who have to take the job seriously, who have to work hard, who can't be accused of slacking or poisoning the well or just, you know, setting a bad example. But if things start to go haywire again, you know, if you have some guys who are performing and some guys aren't, it reminds me last year of seeing Bob Nightingale talking about, like, you know, certain White Sox veterans have made it known that they want to be dealt. And I just took that to mean like Joe Kelly and Lance Lynn, because he seemed to be like, you know, who he talked to, who was quoted in his story. So I assume they were like unquoted in his stories as well, like when things were less flattering. But like, kind of struck me as, you know, as soon as they went 7-21 and as soon as he realized like, oh, they, you know, May is not any better, you started seeing like players looking for life rafts, whether it was like, you know, other organizations or just trying to separate themselves from everything else. And same thing could happen here. Like, it could all blow up again because just the team's not that good. If they're going to win 55 games, like, there's no way to like win 55 games and keep your chin up and say like, yeah, we're doing great here. And he went through the whole culture thing last year. Like, he, like, kind of like the White Sox burned through the rebuild excuse, or like burned through like the rebuild of like a, you know, a tantalizing idea because they tried it and failed. Like, Grifol last year was all about like culture. We're building the culture. We're building the foundation for the culture. We're establishing the blueprints for the foundation of the culture. He just kept like backing up and zooming out and zooming out and zooming out until like players are traded and Keenan Middleton's accusing. And like, you know, Grifol saying, well, we don't have a culture, but we're working on it. So like, he spent the entire time like saying, I know what a culture is. And then like saying that there was one, and then he admitted that there wasn't. So like, you can't take him seriously. So, you know, that's why when Grifol says like, you know, nobody wants to hear what I have to say, that's partially true, because he proved himself an unreliable narrator at the very least, and a liar, or at least like kind of somebody who's like more concerned with self-defense than or self-preservation than somebody who's going to give you an honest account. But there's also a case of like, Grifol is not good at communicating to fans. Like, he doesn't really talk to fans. He talks to Jerry Reinsdorf, he talks to Chris Getz, he talks to like through his media and what he presents. Like, he's talking to other people, but like, he never really connects with fans in any kind of way. Like, he's not somebody who is going to, he doesn't really have a charm offensive in his bag. So like, when he says, you know, fans don't want to hear that to say, that's partially him taking the easy way out and saying like, I'm terrible with fans, so I'm not going to bother. And like, it's kind of like a convenient out for him to say like, ah, they don't care what I have to say. It's kind of like, you know, before I had a kid, I was terrible with kids, and I'm probably still in with other people's kids, but at least I know a little bit more. But like, you know, every Halloween, people would bring the kids in the office, trick or treat, and like, yeah, I'd be like, hey, and it'd be an awkward exchange. And then like, well, that's my attempt to relate to a kid. Better luck next year. And like, any other time in between, just be like, yeah, you know, they don't want to hear from me. And like, yeah, it's partially true, but also I'm terrible at it. So like, you know, it's, you know, yeah, we're kind of meeting each other halfway, or at least, you know, meeting each other outside our own, you know, circles. But yeah, it's, you just really can't believe what he says at any point. And I think that's really his biggest challenge here. Like, year two is, you know, James presented in his interview with Grifol like the best case scenario, which is probably like a competent 75 win team that just is out talented, but like, you know, knows how to play the game. And occasionally it all clicks and you understand like what they're going for. And, you know, if that happens, like, great. But if it doesn't happen a lot of ways, he's already established that like, there's no reason to trust him. So like, what does he have to fall back on if not credibility? Like, when Tony La Russa, when his team was treading water the entire year, like, he had his gravitas, he had his like, I've seen everything, and you know, you could trust that to a certain degree until you realize like, his health was just, you know, probably a bigger obstacle than, you know, he could ever overcome. And even like, yeah, you know, the, you know, just, it just created a insurmountable hurdle. But like, with Grifol, like, showed up face planted, lied about it, kind of, or at least, you know, just tried to talk around it so badly that like, it just proved that like, he showed no concept of what the public was seeing. So yeah, I don't know where you go from here if it's another repeat where it's a 60 win season and you have a lot of mistakes and things falling apart and just like, he's trying to tell you it's going to be okay. That was a very long answer.
Well,
It is, but I mean, you touch on a lot of things that we've talked about in the last decade. Like, that, this is nothing new to the White Sox, Jim. Like, Rick Hahn brought this up, especially 2015 to 2016.
He wanted captains of attitude.
That clubhouse. Yeah, captains of attitude. I want my guys to have an edge. And, like, I don't know what Grifol's getting at with the whole culture, but it's not Grifol. It's just. Culture building is a very corporate buzzword today. So for our podcast listeners who work in the corporate world, you know what I'm talking about, because every organization in the last couple of years, especially after COVID, it's all about company culture. But nobody truly understands what that means. I just think it's a word and a phrase to use to try to get people to buy into a company or an org's long-term plans, and then they can become personally invested in those plans. But I'm a millennial. We are elder millennials in this podcast. Millennials have proven for a decade plus that message goes in one ear and out the other. If somebody calls me and offers me more money or better benefits, see ya. Not really invested in your company culture.
It's a tactic by management to extract more labor from you.
Exactly. Exactly. So Grifol is managing players younger than us. So, especially with Jesse Chavez not making the team. Damn it. But, like, that's just kind of why this topic and White Sox fans on Twitter having a meltdown. And, again, this is not commentary of Chuck Garfine. Chuck did nothing wrong. But and Pedro Grifol State fans don't want to hear from me. For the White Sox and for Chris Getz, I don't want to hear about culture. I think it's important to focus on player development, Jim. Like, what are you looking for out of position groups or certain individuals, because we know James is going to be following that because this is things that he's interested in, on how players are getting better. Because we have zero idea on what the new core is going to be for the 2025 White Sox and beyond. And if culture takes a long time to build, you got 15 new faces on this team or more. Mm-hmm. So, and they're on one-year deals, so it's not guaranteed that they're coming back next year. It's not even guaranteed that Pedro Grifol is coming back next year. If there's anyone that's got to be doing the culture building, it's probably Chris Getz, because he's got the most job security. I'm more focused on player development moving forward and what they're expecting. And I think that should be the messaging coming from the White Sox and not culture.
Yeah, I mean, like, when you look at the White Sox record up top, and then you look at, you know, the record in the farm system and how, like, every year it's pretty much at the bottom or very bottom. Yeah, it's, you know, you're lucky if you get one full season affiliate with a winning record. Like, if I'm looking at culture, and like I wrote last year, like, that at that point, the White Sox record was their culture. Like, they can't separate them and say, like, one's great, one's terrible, and like expect you to believe it. And I think while they're struggling up top, like, it wouldn't hurt to start winning some games in the minor leagues just to show that it's, like, possible to do it. Cause I mean, like, you look at the Rays every year, like, you know, they're a force. Like, you know, it's funny, their draft record, at least up top, is kind of bad. Like, their first round picks aren't that great, but they, you know, they're internationally, they're sound. You know, a lot of value in trades and, like, later round picks. And, like, you look at their farm system and, like, Bowling Green, the Hot Rods in high A, they're in Winston-Salem's league. And, you know, I've watched them kick the Dash's asses, like, multiple times a year in person. And you look at the record, like, oh, they're winning their third straight championship. And then you look at their other affiliates and they're all great. And, like, you know, while minor league wins and losses don't matter too much, it's probably a bad sign that the White Sox affiliates struggle as much as they do. And, like, you talk to, like, you know, people around the ballparks when you go in affiliates and, like, yeah, it's another tough season. You know, you've got some good promotions and such, but just, they'd really like, you know, a championship or at least some postseason excitement to tout, you know, get some life in their broadcasts. And, like, that's kind of what I'm looking at here, is just to see, like, you know, it's one thing to try to, like, pace together a 26 man roster against, like, teams that are actually trying and, like, you know, win more than 70 games, which I think is going to be a really tough slog for them this year. But, like, down below, especially if they're not compelled to rush prospects and they've signed a bunch of players to ensure that emergencies up top won't necessitate, like, accelerated timetables below. Like, it would be nice, I think, if they started winning games and, like, playing better baseball, showing, like, better elements of run prevention, just to have an idea that, like, yeah, they can start winning games upwards together as well.
Charlotte Knights last year were 18-56 in the second half.
Yeah.
And I know I brought this up over time, but that's a 243 winning percentage. They were averaging 4 runs a game. They were allowing 6.6 runs per game. Like, the Charlotte Knights were impossible to watch in the second half last year. So I think that's a good point, Jim. Like, for Chris Getz, if he's worried about this, yeah, it's got to go from Kannapolis all the way up through the minor league system. Wins, a winning minor league organization doesn't necessarily mean a winning organization in the major leagues. But it can't hurt, because getting your ass kicked at every single level is certainly not providing better results to the major leagues. So, yeah, I think Pedro Grifol is going to bring this up. We have our season predictions coming up on SoxMachine.com later this week on opening day. And circle on your calendar May 17th through June 26th. That is a 38-game stretch. And I'm calling it now. We could foresee the worst 38-game stretch in the history of the Chicago White Sox organization. The worst record in a 38-game stretch is 8-30. And I am looking at this list and that schedule, and I don't know how this White Sox team wins 8 games. A road trip to New York and Toronto, followed up with a homestand against Baltimore and Toronto. Then they go to Milwaukee. Then they go to Wrigley. They got a 4-game series against Boston. They go to the West Coast for Seattle and Arizona. Your reward for coming home, 3 games against Houston. Then you have 3 games in Detroit, and your reward for coming home, 3 games against the Dodgers. Yeah, I don't see 8 wins in that 38-game stretch. So we're going to hear a lot about culture before 4th of July. So let's just buckle up. But again, I don't really care for the whole culture topic. Development, player development, that is what's going to be key for the White Sox moving forward. When it comes to the White Sox roster, we're starting to see some last-minute changes. Grifol also hinted that we may not get a finalized 26-man roster until Thursday morning, which is super annoying, but whatever. James, Kevin Pillar's back, and he's got a major league deal, so that means he's going to be on the 26-man roster, right?
It would be somehow even more surprising if they released somebody, re-signed to a guaranteed deal, and then, you know, again. So I think it's safe to say he's on there. He always made sense. Even though they lessened his guarantee after signing his very potential backup or replacement, and thus provided a very reasonable scenario for how he could be out of that role by midseason if he doesn't perform even more than they already had. He seems like a logical platoon partner, but I think they've definitely done their job to let him know he's on borrowed time if he wasn't already on that idea that, you know, he was playing for his career, as, you know, 19 out of 26 roster members have said at this point.
So let me follow up on that. What's the point of signing Robbie Grossman? Because the White Sox also made that signing. So they cut Kevin Pillar. And they signed Robbie Grossman, and my thinking was, oh, well, I guess whatever role Pillar was going to have with the White Sox is going to Robbie Grossman. But then they re-signed Pillar, so when Grossman is ready to go, because he hasn't had a full spring training, like, who is Grossman? What spot on the roster is he taking?
I mean, it's conceivable to see. I mean, just in general, like, the obvious thing is, like, if Pillar doesn't work, or you know, if they have any injury, like, that that provides you a probably more high-powered offensive option. It's probably a little bit tilting away from, like, their, you know, team approach that I think Pillar is probably more in unison with than somebody who's like nice splits, you know, technically plays this position, let's slap a band-aid on it. That seems more like kind of the way the old front office approached roster holes, whereas Pillar seems like more harmonious with their team theme. But I think this is a team that you can logically see being just short on competent bats at points in the season as injuries and poor performance and attrition adds up. So I have a hard time imagining that as they run into issues, or, you know, Gavin Sheets runs into a snag, that they're, you know, looking, if Robbie Grossman is like looking great in AAA for the first couple of weeks, that they're like, man, where can we fit him in our lineup? I think this is a team that will find that situation resolved for them pretty quickly.
So Jim, what do you make of this? Kevin Pillar coming back, Robbie Grossman now in the mix. I guess if you could combine Grossman and Pillar, a good defensive outfielder that took their walks, I mean, they're probably starting in right field for the Chicago White Sox team. Does this spell trouble for Gavin Sheets? I guess, what are your thoughts about these two particular signings?
Yeah, I mean, like, my first thought was, like, did Pillar park in Chris Getz's spots or Tony La Russa's spots? And then just like, all right, you just cost yourself $1 million, jerk. It's like small. Like, that's what it felt like. I'm curious what Grossman was told, because with the way it unfolded for him, like, he signs a minor league deal. And then, like, oh, Pillar's out, so you just need to tune up in AAA, and then we'll have a spot for you. And then, like, Pillar's back. So, like, was he sold a bill of goods or a clearer role? And then all of a sudden, Pillar's there, and if Pillar plays well, like, there's no spot for him until, like, Eloy Jimenez takes the wrong step, and then there's plenty of playing time for Grossman. But, yeah, it struck me as, like, a weird misstep. Like, maybe it saves you $1 million, but, like, if you're trying to get away from, like, boy, Kenny Williams and Rick Hahn operate weirdly, then, like, I don't know if this does well for the reputation. Be like, you know, I took a guy who's playing well in spring training and doing everything we ask him, and then they just got mad that they probably paid a little too much in their minor league deal. Like, they saw what Adam Duvall signed for and realized, like, well, he's not as good as Adam Duvall. So, like, it's kind of like a price match. Like, after the fact, like, you buy a product and being like, oh, the price lowered, I'm going to take it back to the store and ask for the manager, and if I'm going to return this product and then buy it again. That's what it struck me as. And, like, yeah, just that's kind of bush league to me. So Auden is, we're trying to, like, learn how Chris Getz operates. Like, it's not the most, I think, flattering sequence, especially since, like, this $1 million isn't going to count for anything. Like, it's not going to free up, like, money for, like, a player they desperately need for a postseason push. It's just, yeah, it seems like they did it because they could. And that's strange. So, yeah, that's kind of, I haven't heard much about the Grossman part, and I think that's what I'm going to be kind of interested to see. Like, you know, where does he end up? And then, like, does he opt out as soon as possible? Because he realizes, like, oh, there's a little bit more competition than I thought. I was just waiting for a deal. I signed with, like, the worst team in baseball after winning a World Series title. I played okay for them, and now I'm blocked and on a minor league deal when I wasn't. So, like, yeah, it struck me as, like, not very player friendly when, you know, the White Sox, I think, pitching wise, are trying to be player friendly. They're trying to be like, yeah, this is a great place to revive your career. And then on the position player side, it's just like every man for himself. And you watch your back, because promises might not mean much. So, yeah, it's weird. And it's, you know, his reaction, I think, was very telling. Like, kind of looked like he was immediately regretting his initial decisions, I guess, in the winter when the fit made sense, the pay didn't seem out of line, and it should have been, like, a pretty easy, convenient arrangement.
We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
James, is Dominic Fletcher at risk of not making the team, like the White Sox sending him to Charlotte to buy time and maybe roll with a Kevin Pillar and Robbie Grossman veteran platoon until they prove that they can't handle the role?
No, not really. They thought highly of Mana. They traded for Dominic Fletcher on the idea that he would start. I don't think spring is really, and if they were looking at spring, they could say like he's looked better of late and worked through some timing issues at early spring. I don't think they're really looking for spring to make this decision. I think once it was made, they felt like they had the strong side of that platoon, and you know, only injury or suddenly looking like he had was basically injured but still playing would have really convinced them this way out of that.
So then I guess I'm just trying to wrap my head around, Jim, like the point that you just made with like Grossman. I don't know how he gets at bats. Like, I know that's a weird thing to say with this particular roster, but Eloy Jimenez is not playing the outfield. So if Grossman's going to get at bats, he's got to play in the outfield. If the White Sox like Dominic Fletcher, especially defensively in right field, and they're going to be harping on defense in right field, this whole team messaging, and Pillar helps in that case too. Like, Grossman is not a good defensive player. What he provides is a competent offensive bat, especially one that likes to walk. He's not going to get DH at bats. He's not going to get right field at bats. You think he might get DH at bats?
Well, like if Jimenez gets hurt, like there are ways for him to get a lot of playing time in this roster, I think. So he does. And like he provides walks. So it's a case of like if their defense is fine and they're just not getting on base, if they have like the worst on base percentage by like 15 points and not enough power to go with it, then they might say like, we need something here just to kind of show, you know, some kind of example, like, you know, they want players in the field who like show like we know how to throw the right base. We have the timing in mind to where like we don't panic when we fumble a ball. Like they're trying to set the example on the defensive part and the run prevention part, but like it might come a time to where like they've swung too much in that direction and they say like we can give back a little bit of defense just to get some offense, especially ones that address like chase rates and allowing like a you know, pitcher to work through four innings on 34 pitches because of just how aggressive they are in making outs in the first two pitches. So I can see like a usage case for him, especially like given the fragility with Jimenez, like there is a possibility like where you could get a lot of playing time. But it just strikes me as like, it makes sense for the White Sox to sign Grossman to a minor league deal and have that in the queue. It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense for Grossman when Pillar is there, unless like they think like some other spot's going to become available. Like say if Andrew Benintendi gets hurt, or like more of the same, like, you know, he's been pretty healthy, but like if he gets hurt, then Grossman, you know, has an easy way in. So that's where I think like makes sense. If you can sign a Grossman, great. It just, I'm surprised that a guy like Grossman would sign for this team when like the events, like whether Pillar plays well, whether like Zach Deloche shows like he's somebody worth playing, you know, or Fletcher shows like he's more than a platoon bat. Like there are a lot of ways where Grossman can never factor in. And you think a guy with his resume and his ability like to produce for good teams would find a better opportunity, like a cleaner opportunity.
So James, do you think Gavin Sheets is going to be on the opening day roster because Grossman's just not ready?
Yeah, in terms of Grossman's readiness, yeah, it would be open for Sheets. I think he's done at least enough in spring to make a stronger case for this kind of weird amorphous, not quite like the other bench roles, like have a specific defensive utility and they have one spot left that kind of can float around a little bit. And I think he's made a strong case for that as any they have right now. Otherwise, you're just looking at additional, probably superfluous infield depth. It's not a very like steady set position. I think it's kind of as fungible as it gets, but as far as just doing all he can to say that he took the offseason seriously and get his swing in a good place, I think he's done enough to earn that. And he's probably one of the easier people to kind of toss out if things don't click right away for him and insert to somebody you think has a more defined role, like Grossman, you know, hitting against lefties in the outfield corners on both sides.
Yeah, Grossman's never played first base. Like, looking in the history.
How hard can it be?
Yeah, right. How hard can it be? Because if you don't have Sheets, you don't really have a backup first baseman in case Andrew Vaughn got hurt during a game. I guess, I don't know, can Martín Maldonado play first base?
Braden Shoemaker, yeah, like 6'4", just stand there.
Yeah, Braden Shoemaker is taller than a guy like named Braden Shoemaker would seem to be. Like, I when I saw Braden Shoemaker, like the name, I thought like, oh, he's like 5'10", 5'9". Mm. He's like, yeah, 6'3", 6'4", something like that.
Yeah, so we're looking at a bench of Max Stassi, because we're assuming Martín Maldonado is the opening day catcher. Kevin Pillar, Braden Shoemaker, and for the time being, Gavin Sheets until Robbie Grossman's ready.
Well, Max Stassi is, his forecast is now uncertain just because he hasn't played in 4 days and they're saying he has general soreness. So, Corey Lee, fortunately, he's played
he
well.
He becomes your primary DH because of just the power of his bat as shown in spring. And then the whole thing's in a flux. Then he needs their catcher.
Poor Eloy going to the bench. No, I'm kidding. Eloy will be the opening day DH, but
I'm picturing Eloy catching.
Eloy, grab a first base glove. Maybe that's your best chance of getting back in the field. So on the position player side, it's a bit confusing heading to opening day. It could be much ado about nothing because we're talking about players that might not be very good for the White Sox, but it is, again, trying to understand with the new general manager, Chris Getz, on how he makes moves, his thought process making moves, because I'm assuming he's going to be the general manager for a while for the Chicago White Sox. So this is one of those things we have to learn. The other side, on the pitching side, Jordan Leisure, according to Daryl Van Scowen of the Chicago Sun-Times, and also confirmed by our beat reporter James Fegan, will be added to the White Sox bullpen. So, James, let's talk about this White Sox bullpen. Before we started recording, a lot of new faces. And I jotted down, and I don't even know if everyone's healthy. That's the other thing. So, Steven Wilson, they got from the Padres. He's alive. John Brabia, he's been pitching. I'm assuming he's going to be ready to go. Michael Kopech's throwing 101. We'll get to him in a moment. Is Tim Hill alive?
Yes.
Okay. Jimmy Lambert.
Injured. Shoulder.
Okay. So then Jordan Leisure. So I'm at five. Obviously Brian Shaw, because somebody needs to pitch in this bullpen. But he's not on the 40-man roster. Who else is going to be part of this bullpen for the White Sox? Because I'm drawing blanks.
Has anyone been better than Tanner Banks in spring training? Come on.
All right. Yeah, your guy, Tanner. So let's replace Jimmy with Tanner. All right, in my little spreadsheet.
I didn't hear David Garcia.
Yeah, David Garcia is on the 40-man. So
has he been pitching?
If they...
Yeah, he's been pitching...
Pretty well. I think he got roughed up his last outing, but
doesn't count.
Before then, it was pretty smooth sailing.
You drop your lowest test score. He's fine.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. So Davey Garcia. All right. So again, Wilson, Brabia, Kopech, Hill, Banks, Leisure, Garcia. Who's your eighth guy? Is it Shaw?
I'm putting my very cautious money on Dominic Leone.
Are you doing the same, Jim?
That's what it feels like, just based on Shaw. Just he, you know, his command was rocky. Like part of the, I think, thing with Shaw is like he took a while to like get into gear last year as well. So like he just has a lot of miles on his arm. So I just wonder like if he's just running out of either bullets or just takes a while to ramp up because of just how often he's thrown. Like he was terrible last year in July, took a while to warm up with the Knights. So like it could be a slow starter type thing, but like I wouldn't count Shaw out. Like I could see him being like, yeah, I'll pitch in Charlotte because you're going to need me again. You'll come crawling back to old Brian Shaw and I'll be pitching in, you know, throughout four games for the remainder of the season. Like I can see that being the case. I think Leone's somebody who like still has, you know, he's still close enough to like his prime production to where like, if he opted out and the White Sox let him go, like he could end up somewhere and have a nice season and the White Sox would say, oh, we could have used that. I think Shaw, like they saw what he offered, which was a lot of appearances, but like, you know, you won't have much in the way of trade value or even like being flipped for somebody mildly interesting. Whereas like Leone is more likely, I think, to be a flippable candidate. So like, I'm kind of leaning that way as well, because, you know, I think he's basically just had one blip of an outing. Otherwise, he's been pretty good, like throwing strikes, getting ground balls. So, like, he looks like he should look. And that's a pitcher who's been able to, you know, be a decent part of a bullpen for some pretty good teams.
So Tuki Toussaint was designated for assignment because of the Kevin Pillar signing, and Pillar being added to the 40-man roster. The 40-man roster, according to Roster Resource, is at 40. So who are the White Sox? Who's ready to go on the 60-day injured list, James? Is that Drohan, the Rule 5 pick?
He'd be a possibility, I guess. Like, they more thought he was supposed to start a throwing program around the end of spring, but how much that would take to, one, start ramping him up again, getting him throwing bullpens, and then to the point where you probably max out his rehab assignment to give him as much minor league reps as possible, seeing as, you know, probably was iffy about him making a team in the first place. You could probably do that. I don't know. I haven't received an exact update on his prognosis beyond the fact that the throwing program is supposed to start at the end of spring, but I would think he'd be in the territory for that. Jimmy Lambert certainly doesn't sound super promising. Even if he's trying to avoid surgery right now, it doesn't seem like there would necessarily be a timeline where you could immediately expect him. So if they put him on the 60 day, that wouldn't be the most surprising thing ever.
Yeah, I'm wondering if that's the route, because I don't know if they're going to be cutting more people. Like, looking at the 40-man roster.
Yeah, like, Sammy Peralta is the only guy from the previous administration. Like, Getz has pretty much turned over all of the guys that, like, Rick Hahn acquired, or, like, you know, his era acquired. So, like, Peralta is really the last man standing. Everybody else on the roster was pretty much his idea.
I mean, I think they could get Jose Rodriguez through waivers at this point, especially if they're not really considering part of the depth the way that they were when they made the decision to add him. Alex Spies was obviously somebody who was bouncing around on waivers when they got him. A bit of a shame. It'd be a nice risk for a team like this to take, but obviously if it didn't click really in spring, or they didn't see a jump in control, I think it's a chance they could conceivably take. Jose Marcosin is a little bit it's just kind of the treatment around him has been weird in general. He's a little bit previous regime, but they also kind of rushed to put him on the 40 man when they didn't have to. Mm-hmm. That I would argue that they probably can sneak him through without issue, but if they thought enough of that as a priority to put him on the 40 man in the first place, maybe they're not inclined to do that, since he's vital to them for reasons that have not yet played out in front of our eyes.
Yeah, he had some kind of like split contract when he signed, like weird late. Right. So like perhaps it was like a condition where, like, you know, I have the right to opt out, and yeah, they, who knows, but.
Approaching opening day, though, like sneaking guys through waivers, this has got to be easier to do it, right, Jim, as far as this time frame? Because every team in Major League Baseball is trying to keep their prospects and have that type of depth. I don't know how many teams are going to be raiding other people's farm systems, especially the White Sox 40-man roster.
When you look at who they're possibly cutting and all the names we mentioned, like maybe Rodriguez, like, is the most interesting, or at least, you know, you've seen him at his best. Whereas others, like, you know, like Spies, like, don't really know exactly, you know, what he looks like as a strike thrower. You know, Jose Marcosin, like, same thing. Like, it's not a clear, like, what he does. So yeah, when you're talking about like the White Sox shedding these guys, like the reason why, like, the White Sox, or why they're interesting in the White Sox, is because, like, they're as flawed as everybody else who's on the 26-man roster, or at least the spots they're competing for. So it's not really they're going to be good. It's like they just might be better than the guy who might be bad, who's currently in their spot. So, like, that's, you know, as we're discussing it, focusing on this specific organization, I can't see, like, other teams looking at it and saying, like, yeah, the White Sox just have some gems that they don't know about. Like, I think given all the playing time they've been able to spread out to, like, anybody who looks possibly deserving, like, I think they're probably more known than, like, other teams back end of the 40-man roster.
Well, on SoxMachine.com, James wrote an excellent article headlined, "How Can White Sox Pitching Development Be Different This Year?" And James, I think you did an excellent job breaking this down and providing excellent insight on how the White Sox are going to go about player development. Again, coming full circle from the conversation earlier in this show. This is what's important to me, and I'm sure what's important to you podcast listeners and those that read on SoxMachine.com. How is this team and how are the players going to get better? And I'm really now curious when it comes to the White Sox bullpen and how Michael Kopech makes this transition again. In 2021, he was fantastic out of the bullpen. When the White Sox made this transition during spring training, Kopech coming in relief, he's throwing harder. Chris Getz really likes the type of stuff that Kopech is demonstrating on the mound when he's not focusing on being a starting pitcher. Is this a, I guess, test case for the White Sox, at least in the major league level, to see what they can get out of Michael Kopech, or at least reshape his development on the fly here?
Yes, in terms of like the specific stuff that the new pitching development group is talking about in terms of his delivery, or what they want to focus on, and being a little bit less absolute about like get the perfect four seam spin and a bit more like let's just point you at the plate a little bit, or allow you to not spin out in your delivery so much, and maybe think more in terms of just what your fastball is doing and working with it and locating it a little bit more than trying to, you know, throw the perfect four seam right fastball. But also, like, at this point, if Kopech fails a starter and works in the bullpen, you know, 200 scouts who last like looked in at Kopech in 2015 will be like, oh yeah, I was right. He's a reliever, just like we thought, coming out of high school. So I don't know if it'd be like, it's a good test case in the sense there's real work behind it, but also this is kind of what everyone thought he'd settle into at some point. We were on the low end of him, so I don't know if it'd be necessarily like a, see, we've made the, you know, 80 high school fastball guy into a successful reliever. I don't know if it'd be like this is our shining example of our pitching development as much as this is maybe something that could have happened in 1978 just as easily.
That's a good point.
I did get a response because you bring him up made me check in on it, that Brian Shaw is apparently is likely to make the team, so you can put him as one of your that you're projecting for here for. And obviously now the pitching development plan is just for Kopech to learn it from Brian Shaw, like every reliever is required to.
I like the idea. I know we talked about piggybacking, especially when we were joking, but it became true that Garrett Crochet is going to be the opening day starter for the White Sox, maybe piggybacking Crochet and Kopech. I think from a White Sox perspective, it might be more valuable to have Michael Kopech in those high leverage situations, Jim, and maybe he is your closer to start the season to rebuild some value. Because if the White Sox don't believe he's a starting pitcher, no one's going to believe he's a starting pitcher. But if he's lights out for whatever save opportunities the White Sox do have, it may create a situation come July in the trade deadline that somebody picks up the phone and says, hey, we'd like Michael Kopech, the reliever, to help us out as we are looking for a sixth, seventh inning guy. I think in the however many years the White Sox have control of Kopech, I think it's just 2 years. I think that's the biggest benefit now, is just moving Kopech to be the White Sox closer. Do you agree with that idea, or do you think they should go in a different direction for closing out games?
At least like high leverage, like the White Sox might not be able to reserve like a closer. Like they might not have enough games to close where like if they have
that's a good point.
Like Kopech like hanging around for like leads in the ninth inning, like he might pitch once every 5 days. Whereas like if he's showing some versatility, like, you know, he's a closer, but he's also like eighth inning of a tie game, or you know, facing the toughest hitters in the part of the lineup, kind of like the way Grifol used Reynaldo Lopez last year. Unfortunately, like Lopez was off his game and just took like, I don't know, like 3 weeks for the White Sox to realize it wasn't working. But like that kind of role to where like he can handle the bright lights, or he can handle being thrown in the eighth inning. You don't get it like a Craig Kimbrell situation where like, he can be acquired, but he's a very delicate flower. He can only pitch in one specific situation. And if he's, if he has to pitch in the eighth and the ninth, he's going to get all screwed up. Like, I think it makes sense for the White Sox to have some versatility in his appearances, so you don't like pigeonhole him in. But I think it makes sense, like probably one inning or like one plus inning, because, you know, thinking about his fastball and thinking about like how they had to extract like maximum effect on his fastball, it's because like, well, he had to face like the lineup multiple times, and so like if he's not going to be able to go slider first the second time through, or like start like mixing the changeup third way through. Like if it's going to be like fastball slider and probably fastball first, at least like through the first half of the game, then it made sense to like make sure that fastball was on point for as long as possible. Whereas like if he's coming out for an inning and throwing like harder, then it's probably more simple in terms of just like, yeah, throw your really good fastball. Don't worry about setting him up for the next time. Just especially if he's like coming in after, you know, who's going to be like the, yeah, Tim Hill or something like that. Like all of a sudden they go from seeing like low 90s, high 80s from a sidewinding position to like all of a sudden 101 from the right. Like it could be a very confusing look because the White Sox, aside from Leisure, don't have much in the bullpen that look like him. And maybe that helps just make him a little bit more special when he only has to throw, you know, 15, 20 pitches and doesn't have to worry about efficiency. Like if he throws 23 pitches in an inning, that's fine. Like he sits for 2 days instead of one. That's really the only kind of lasting effect of that versus like 23 pitch first inning. Then you're wondering like, oh, is he going to throw 30 in the second? And is the bullpen going to have to get ready in the third? Like it's a lot more straightforward, I think, in terms of like how he attacks hitters and then like how the White Sox handle it if it doesn't go like perfectly.
The White Sox may not have that many save opportunities. It would feel like watching The Office of Michael Scott, that scene. Oh my God, it's happening. Like in the ninth inning, they have a lead. Who's available to close? Kopech, are you ready? You have a lead.
We've had seven innings of relievers because our starter got knocked out in the second.
I'm gonna love this team.
The Jim's point, you could say like, hey, you can save, and then to the contending teams you're selling him to is like, and he can also pitch well in the innings you'll use him at, which is like the six or seven. You exactly. Have a bullpen already.
Exactly. So James, when you look at this projected White Sox bullpen, which arm or arms intrigue you the most that you're going to be following or tracking them closely?
This is where I like always psych myself out. And instead of just saying like Jordan Leisure, because he has like this really unique, like forcing fastball vertical, or his VAA is good. It's from what I understand that it plays up more than just like force being right and velocity. And that gives him a chance to really pop in a way that, you know, maybe other than maybe Kopech, there's not really that kind of ceiling in the relief group. I was trying to find ways to like talk myself into some weird reliever who has like one good trait that doesn't really work out. So I'm tempted to want to do that again. I don't know. I can't convince myself Davey Garcia is suddenly going to be like two grades better than he's ever been in his life. Leisure is the most interesting guy. I'd be fascinated if Tanner Banks, like if his usage calmed down, that he just became like a decent seventh inning guy, and that became something valuable, and then he became like a trade asset at this like absurdly late stage of his career. That would be cute, I guess, if that happened. David Garcia obviously has like a little bit of prospect shine to him, and has got hurt with the Yankees, and there was someone that they thought his fastball could, you know, be the start of a starter profile. So I always wonder like if something clicked with him, but it's also been 3-4 years and he's undersized, and I don't know what I should wait for or if I've seen anything particular this spring, but there's all of them would be a surprise at this point. It's almost like the most interesting things are not like their guaranteed performers like Brevia and Tim Hill, who have kind of showed what their ceiling is and they're more likely to hit it, but it's like, you know, good medium leverage guy, whereas like if one of these random guys who might not be a big leaguer pops, that's like the interesting story from this season with the bullpen.
Jim, do you agree with Leisure, or is there anyone else catching your eye?
Yeah, Leisure is the one you have confidence in, and the rest are kind of more random guesses. I think Steven Wilson, Ben Clemens made the point in Fangraph saying like, oh, you know, he's got the kind of arsenal where I'm like, maybe could stretch him out and be like, if not a starter, at least somebody can go two innings regularly. And like, this is probably the bullpen, or at least the rotation, that affords some like creative long relief usages that might be allow a guy to show more than he showed previously. So that kind of has my attention in terms of like, you know, do the White Sox have ambitions for Steven Wilson besides just we need somebody in the bullpen who is going to be around for like, you know, we could project for like 3 years of being okay. The other guy I think is, you know, based on what he'd shown previously in the majors before injury interfered, was Jake Cousins, who like when he's healthy, Like, his slider is really good, and he can strike out a ton of batters, and he's done it for good teams. Like, he did it for the Brewers and, like, came out of nowhere and, like, all of a sudden was a pretty important part of the Brewers bullpen. And, like, you know, the Brewers get by on, like, those success stories coming up and, like, popping, and all of a sudden they're way better than the names on the roster say they should be. And he's been throwing pretty well, it seems, this spring. Like, I think it's a question of, like, when he's got a shoulder problems in his past, like, does the way he throw the ball prevent him from staying healthy from long stretches? So, like, that's why I'm not going to say, like, he's going to be a big part of the bullpen. But, like, if he is able to stay healthy and, like, the White Sox have some way of, like, making sure he doesn't, like, overdo it or, like, kind of, like, put his body in a position that, like, you know, causes more stress than he can absorb. Like, he's somebody I think maybe, like, by May or June is like, oh, he's, like, the best reliever by far in Charlotte. Let's get him up here because we have some pieces that aren't working. And he turns out to be okay. I just question whether he can actually stay healthy enough to be that guy for long. But if he is, like, I could see him maybe being somebody who does garner some interest as, like, one of those small Keenan Middleton-like trades.
So long-term, when it comes to the bullpen, James, is the White Sox focus priority, make it a priority that they develop the relievers? Because we made fun of the Rick Hahn and Kenny Williams regime in their last couple of years running things that they spent all their cash on relievers to avoid that pitfall. Are Brian Bannister and Ethan Katz and everyone within the White Sox organization helping on the pitching front long-term, are they focused on trying to develop guys to be their bullpen so they could spend assets elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, I would think that the last front office at least realized that, but just wasn't as good at it. Whereas now this is like the personnel in place where you at least have seen a track record of finding those kind of scrap heap guys. I mean, I think back in maybe the heyday of Don Cooper, they were a bit more proficient at it in a way where we got to see them not have to invest so much free agent capital in the bullpen. And I also think they got into a spot where they were trying to spend to compete more, but ran into their limits about what they could really afford. And, you know, that at least influenced the way they allocated a bit, even if you could still raise a lot of objections to how they did it within that those parameters. I think something that may be a giveaway of their leanings is the next one, a couple of 2 years where you saw even in down cycles, Hahn reaching out to, you know, trade Narvaez for Colome just for a stake of like kind of stabilizing the way the game's operated, or reaching out for Kelvin Herrera with a non-contention year. He's still kind of invested in the bullpen in this way that seemed not really in keeping with the full, otherwise full tank effect that the roster had. And I think if Getz is able to stave off those deviations through, you know, whether it's developing internally or just simply going without out of the idea that we're not going to trade like what might be a plus hitting catcher for two innings, two seasons of a reliever, that would be encouraging. But certainly having the tools in place to resist it by building your own, that would be a positive development. I just feel like every team's trying to do that all the time. And it's just it's about who can avoid the more extreme results on either side.
Well, one guy we didn't talk about in terms of like somebody who could like emerge and like, I'm not sure what to think about him because of the shoulder issue, but like Prelander Baroa, like before the season or like, you know, early in spring, I would have thought like, oh, he's somebody could be like a contributor for most of the year in the bullpen. But now like his spring was cut off basically like March 11th. So I'm not sure like, you know, if it's like a Gregory Santos, like, cursed trade on both sides, so we're like they're never quite fully operational. But he's somebody, I guess, like if he is able to bounce back, it's just like a spring, you know, early bump setback that can be easily overcome. I guess he would be somebody in the mix as well, because I think if he got through the spring fully healthy, he might be somebody who might be competing for a spot, or at least be like, because he has options, like ready for like the first sign of turnover to be somebody who maybe provides that kind of like high impact arm.
I'm expecting to see a lot of faces in the White Sox bullpen this year, Jim. Is that your expectation as well, that they could maybe weeks at a time, they could be a consistent unit, but it's going to be a revolving door and who's part of the White Sox bullpen?
Yeah, it's kind of weird because like when you look at the bullpen, like they have a lot of guys like, you know, Hill, Brebbia, Wilson, like they're around and like part of like good bullpens, like they've been part of good bullpens. But then you realize like who are the high leverage guys, and then do the high leverage guys like make, you know, it, like say if Brebbia gets thrown into more save situations than he, you know, ever encountered with the Giants, or if Wilson is all of a sudden like a late inning guy versus a mid inning guy with San Diego and like they don't handle it well. That's kind of what I'm wondering is like, does that stress cause problems to where like all of a sudden guys look worse, or kind of like the way the lineup has like three or four nine hitters? It seems like the bullpen has a lot of guys who should be pitching in the sixth inning, except there's more than the sixth inning. So like, you know, if you know, Leisure doesn't click right away, or if Kopech is, you know, his usual erratic self, like, you know, do guys get thrown in situations they're not suited for? And then is it all just kind of a mess? So that's kind of think, you know, the names I think present more stability on paper than I think like the overall production of the bullpen would signal. It's just a matter, I think, of like, how deep do the starters go? How much are these guys taxed? And is it more of a case of like ineffectiveness or overuse that the White Sox have to like go into the, you know, deeper into their AAA reserves to find help, because like all of a sudden the bullpen is like covering, you know, five innings a game for like a week and a half at a time.
Hey, if they've been with the Charlotte Knights for a while, they're used to it, man.
18 and 56. Is that what you said?
18 and 56. Yeah. Five game series, not having a starting pitcher available. So a different pitcher every inning. Come ready to throw, White Sox bullpen. You're going to be needed. And we'll see on how Pedro Grifol, to come full circle, manages this unit along with Ethan Katz. But now you do have Brian Bannister, part of the White Sox front office. So that'll be a new twist as well. And hopefully the culture is good for the White Sox bullpen. So when they do have a lead to help with everyone's feelings about this season and get them to stay around for a little bit, they're able to close those leads when they do have them in the upcoming season. But that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening as we are now inching closer to opening day for the Chicago White Sox. Again, that's going to be on Thursday. First pitch is at 3 o'clock. The gates will be open at 1:10 p.m. Central Time. The parking lots will be open at 12:10 p.m. Central Time for the White Sox and the Detroit Tigers, as Tarik Skubal will take the ball for the Detroit Tigers and Garrett Crochet will take the ball for the Chicago White Sox. For us at Sox Machine, we are hosting a live podcast at the Remova Theater Wednesday night. So the night before, it's our opening day Eve show. Doors open at 7 o'clock. The show will start at 8 o'clock. Tickets are still available at RemovaChicago.com. We already have over 125 people that are going to be in that room with us. So we're really excited. Jim will be there. James will be there. We'll also have special guests joining us too. And of course, our friends from the 108. So if you have no plans Wednesday night and you want to come hang out with us getting hyped for the White Sox opening day, go to RemovaChicago.com and secure your tickets today. You must be over the age of 18 to attend. And again, thank you so much for listening to this Sox Machine podcast. You can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. You can also subscribe to the Sox Machine YouTube channel at youtube.com/Sox Machine. I've been putting up highlights of some of the top 2024 MLB draft prospects. You kind of stay in tune with what they are doing. It was a big weekend for the top prospects, especially in conference play. We'll have more highlights and you can watch those at youtube.com/Sox Machine and follow us on social media. We're on all the social media platforms at Sox Machine. You can follow James at JR Fegan, and you can follow me at Sox_Machine_Josh. If you enjoy our work and you want full access of our White Sox coverage and help us help James so we can continue to send him out on the road. Again, we're sending him to Kansas City and Minneapolis, St. Louis, and Milwaukee to cover those road games. And of course, he'll be covering all of the home games as well. To gain full access to that coverage, sign up at patreon.com/Sox Machine. We're already over 1,200 members. Thank you to everyone that has signed up so far. You still have time to do so at patreon.com/Sox Machine. We also have different tiers of support. So if you really like our content and you want more, you can get more. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com. You're home for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis and James Fegan, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.